We are on this series on goal setting for success, and we have many requests to teach on this area after the series on prosperity and on dreams, because we realize that many people want to achieve something in life, but we need practical advice on setting our goals and how to achieve them. And if you remember what we said last week, the few statements we made about how people could be categorized into different income groups, and each income group needs to set different goals according to their capacity. Those from 0 to 500 will have slightly different goals, and those from 500 to 1,000, and those from 1,000 to 2,000, 2,000 to 3 to 4, 5,000 to 10,000, and those 10,000 and above of their monthly income, they will all have different goals that they need to set. If you don't set goals, you'll find that at the end of your years on earth, you're still roughly the same place where you are. We believe, every single one of us here believe that Jesus died on the cross to redeem us from the curse of the law. But at the end of 10 or 20 years, we look around and we say, how come the same Jesus, but different application, different manifestation in each one of our lives? It depends on our faith level, and our faith level has to be practical. It has to be something that we are able to actualize into our lives, to make it tangible, to make it something that we could feel, touch, and see from something spiritual. And we make statements about worldly assets and achievement of them, although we realize that these are not the most important thing in life, but there are so many other emphases that we have on the spiritual areas, and we need to also touch on these areas too. Basically, if your income is 0 to 500, you cannot take any debt level at all. Don't ever go into any debt because you are not capable to handle those debts. From 0 to 500, the only debt level you will be able to handle will be in the area of pursuing your career and education. Whether you took a scholarship or you took a study loan in order to advance and pursue your career. And from 0 to 500, it's not possible to think about even an apartment or a flat. The only possibility is this, is that you combine perhaps your family members, where perhaps there are four family members earning from 0 to 500, so your total income is 2,000. Then together as one unit, you could set the goals that a person who's earning about 2,000 could set in the purchase of an apartment or a home. But otherwise, alone, you cannot, and it's not advisable at all. And if you're alone, the only main goals that you have to set are in the area of developing your career, developing your educational level, and pursuing those things. At the most, you will be able to handle a debt level of between 2,000, and if you really stretch it and eat very, very simple, maybe just plain rice, a bit of soy sauce once in a while, a few vegetables, then you could and stretch it to 4,000 to 5,000 dollar debt, but that's not advisable. We're talking about debt level that you could be comfortable with, you could handle the repayment. So 0 to 500, you could only handle educational goals. 2,000 to 3,000 that will cost you at the most, and you could stretch it out. But if your income is between 500 to 1,000, you could comfortably handle a debt level of 30,000, and if you stretch it to about 45,000. Now, if you try to calculate it by percentage, you'll find that it's not an exact gradient, an exact fixed percentage of a certain income. Why is that so? Because basically, how much it costs for you to keep yourself remain stable, whether you're earning 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, or 500. It's only the different amount and quality of food that you take. Basically, it costs the same to feed a person. So that is why the more you advance into a higher income group through your faith in God, the greater your debt level you're able to tolerate. So between 500 to 1,000, you will be able to handle easily a debt level of 30,000 to 45,000. That is equivalent to a simple apartment. You could handle it. If your income is between 1,000 to 2,000, you could comfortably handle a debt level of perhaps about 80,000. And you stretch it to about 100,000. Now, some at that level are already stretching to 150,000 debt level. And I realized that last week we talked about different types of houses and apartments. But perhaps we should have qualified in terms of amount. Because a double-story house far, far away would still cost perhaps less than 100,000. Whereas within the city, you cannot even find it. You can only find a simple apartment. So perhaps it would be a better comparison to talk about debt level. And so debt level, the ability which you could handle a debt, and how much we could move into a housing loan or some purchase of fixed assets. If your income is within 2,000 to 3,000, you could comfortably handle a debt level of about 150,000 if you really stretch it to 2,000, but you have to live very simply. Don't forget taxes too, that will eat up part of your income the more you go. And of course, if your income is about 3,000 to 4,000, you could begin to look into other forms and means of investment. And to look into that. Remember that the price, the quality of the car, of your house, depends very much on your ability to handle debt. It's very unlikely for a person today to be able to just buy a house cash or buy their car cash at today's prices. And we need to set goals, otherwise inflation will catch up on you, and if you maintain your same income with about 5% extra per annum, you cannot handle it in 10 years' time. You'll be wondering why God didn't supply your needs, and you cannot blame God, because God has given all His principles, all His word, and He expects us to work at it, to apply it to our daily lives. The second area, even when we talk about purchase of a house, remember this, the goal for purchasing a house or an apartment is preceded by a goal and an ability to save. If you have never been able to save substantially, then you are not able to handle a home. And it's people who have never learned how to save up after paying their tithes and offerings. They learn to save. People will never learn to save $1,000, save to $10,000. It takes time to build up. Why? Because the things of this world will lure you. Spend, spend, spend. You go to the supermarket and their background masking says spend, spend, spend. Spend all you have. While in the kingdom of God, it says give all you have. But in the world, it says spend all you have. And you spend all you have, you don't get anything in return except what you spend for. When you give all you got in God, at least there's a return. It's a seed that is sown. But there is something that we need to also emphasize, because after hearing this message, I shudder to think that some of you may begin to launch into houses when you haven't even established your ability to save, and that will be rushing ahead. In other words, even if you want to pay a down payment for your house, you need some savings. And I don't think it's advisable to put 100% of your savings. It won't be smart, it won't be wise, it won't be good steward. Perhaps you could put about 50% of your savings, and you could stretch it to 75%, and have at least that amount to continue to build while you're building on your house. Remember, there are a lot of things that go with a house. Expenditure goes up. Just like a person who buys a car, they didn't realize there's insurance, there's maintenance, and all this that can eat a big chunk of their money. And overall, it's cheaper to go by bus or bus 11. But you have to be able to handle the maintenance. Same with a house. So that is why it is not advisable to eat 100% of your savings and dump it all into debt after hearing this kind of message. Your ability to save must be maintained. And savings is not against faith. We already touched that in our financial prosperity series, so we won't repeat that. And it's nothing against faith. It's part of the principles of God that we apply. And you need to build that ability to save. And besides that, third area that we just need to revise and touch on before we go more into Nehemiah and talk about goal setting and things that we could achieve. A third area that we need to look at after looking at number one, debt levels of different income groups, how much they're able to handle, and second, we look about how savings precedes house buying, the ability to save. And the third area And in regard to what we had mentioned last week, is how we would all need to work towards some sort of financial independence, where you got about 30 odd years if you start working at 21 to set goals where you could take care of these worldly things. You see, it's after the fall of man that man has to earn a living. And it would be a very, very small goal for you if all you have as your goal in life is to earn a living. Then you don't have much other ability to develop other talents that God has placed in your life. And so we should all set goals, but with perhaps by the age of 55, or if you started late, then set it at the age of 60 or 70, where by that time you will be able to free yourself, to entirely free yourself from the syndrome of work making a living, to establish yourself in some way so that you could, even if you're not called but into full time, you could give yourself to perhaps a spiritual pursuit in your life that could prepare you for eternity. We all need to set some sort of goals in that manner. And we have talked about how Nehemiah set those goals. We talk about fixation in those goals. And how a goal is not a wish or just a desire. A desire and a wish don't have a chronological period. Neither are they very detailed. So a goal is not a wish, it's more than a wish. A goal means there's a time span you plan within a certain chronological period to achieve those things. If you didn't achieve that, you evaluate why you didn't achieve those areas. So in the book of Nehemiah, we're going to look at how after you set goals and after you move into those goals, some areas that we need to overcome. In other words, what is involved in working out our goals? We talk about all the necessary things you need to have to set those goals in your life. And now we talk about working out those goals. What is involved in working out those goals? The book of Nehemiah, chapter 2. And let's read from verse 11 onwards. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And I went up by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuse gate, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were burned with fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall. Then I turned back and entered by the valley gate, and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. Now, number one, in working out your goals, Nehemiah observed a period of silence. There are many days of silence when he just surveyed the place. He looked carefully. It may not just have been one night. That's a period of silence. See, sometimes you have to tell you have to balance between telling your goals and not telling your goals. We'll explain why afterwards. Now, let me just point to his life first. There's a period of silence when he moved into those areas and surveyed the place, touched it with his hands, saw it with his eyes, what he actually had to do. He didn't depend on somebody to tell him what he had to do. If you have goals in your life, don't depend on somebody to tell you what you have to do. For example, if you set your goal to get an education in life, you just started in life, your father couldn't send you, your mother couldn't send you, your uncle couldn't send you, no uncle's bank give you inheritance. All you had is to work with your hands to support yourself, to get an education which you didn't have to. You could have been the eldest in the family, and situation is such that you got to go out and work early even before you got an education. And now you're thinking about education, you're able to support yourself in that area. Last week we talked about consultation, but remember, there's nothing like having your own evaluation. Because in the end, you are the one who's going to face it. You're the one who's going to face a refuse heap. The walls that need to be built up, not somebody else. And remember, what somebody else share with you and tell you how they climb that mountain. The mountain of education that you need to climb, they could be climbing it from a different place. There could be many ways of climbing the same mountain. And so there's nothing like finding it out yourself. Get all the information you can. Find it out for yourself. And then develop your plan. I believe what Nehemiah was doing when he was surveying the place was he was trying to conceive a plan. A plan to achieve what he had come to set about as his goal. To build the walls of Jerusalem. So he surveyed. He had actual hands-on contact with what he had to face. So there was a silent period. Then on the other side, there's a time to tell others. There's a time to gather the people. Immediately after that, in chapter 2, in verse 17, then I said to them, and the them referred to the nobles, the leaders of the land, and the common people. It says, you are distressed. You see the distress that we are in. And how Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come, let us build the walls of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach. So there's a time when he told the people. And after he told them, he organized them. In chapter 3, you find the organization into different teams. Each team headed by different people. And they broke into teams and they organized the work for building the walls of Jerusalem. So in chapter 2, from that verse onwards up to the whole of chapter 3, you find that there's involvement of people. Involvement of people in the goals that he has set. So there's a time when you have to be silent, there's a time when you've got to work with people. And the people you work with need to know what your goals are, need to know what your objectives are. How can you expect someone to work for you and you don't tell them what you want to achieve? Of course not, they'll be working blindly. And they won't be able to achieve targets that you set. So there's a time that you have to inspire others. There's a silent period, and this other period is, this other area that comes from Nehemiah's life, is an area that we call the charisma. Now we're going to talk more about that. Charisma in the world is used wrongly, and people talk about charisma in a negative terms. And people talk about charisma as if it is natural. Some people are born with it. It's not. There are causes and effects. Charisma is something you could learn, you could acquire. And everyone needs some sort of charisma to inspire others in some way. We'll explain that afterwards. Now let's look at these two areas. The first is experience, the silent spirit. The second is charisma in its relationship to others in its goal setting. In the area of experience, there are reasons for not telling others, because not everybody will be in support of your goal. Why do we set goals? Because they are obstacles. God hasn't made it that this life is easy. All you have to do is do nothing and fail. It's such that there is an effort involved. And during this silent period, you are planning your strategy. You're digging deep into God. Some things are told too early and they get aborted. One illustration that you could have, for example, is Fred Price. When he was building his church in the first, he has completed the building of his church in Potato University, and they developed it in the huge premises. But that was his second attempt. In his first attempt, he bought a piece of land, and all the publicity ran out, but the wrong people got that publicity. And as a result, on the area of the land where they were building, there were a lot of opposition from the residents in those areas. It became a public issue. And finally, the whole thing has to be aborted. I remember how even locally, A minister of God has a land given, designated for church. In his excitement, he took a whole bunch of his church people. Almost the whole church was there. They had a public gathering. The next day, there was a phone call and a complaint. Authorities took over and said, no, we cannot give you now. The others around you are not happy. See, there's sometimes when you've got to keep quiet. Not say anything. Don't say too much. Don't give too much information. Why? Who are we hiding it from? The devil and his cohort. You understand now why God put the Bible in parables? Because the devil can read English. Why are the Bible truths not in order? I mean, if some of us were to write the Bible, we will write, number one, these are the truths that a new believer must have. Number three, the Bible is not that way, it's not that systematic, it's all over the place. You've got to bring it together. That's why you have preachers like myself and some others. Why is it that way? Because when the devil reads it, he doesn't understand. You need the same Holy Ghost who wrote this Bible to put it together. It is like a jigsaw puzzle inside here. There are a lot of things that can teach you about prosperity, about your business, but they are not all systematic. It's all over the place like a jigsaw puzzle. And the only guy who can put the jigsaw puzzle together is the Holy Ghost. So God puts it that way so that there's an extra effort needed. There's extra bit time to put it together. Because God has enemies. When David fell into sin, God told David that he has made his enemies, God's enemies, rejoice. So because there's an enemy, remember there is an enemy. Christians live as if there's no enemy. Now your enemy is not your neighbor, not the one who lives under the same roof as you. Don't jump to that conclusion. Don't you dare. Your enemy is not flesh and blood. But there's a spiritual enemy out there who from time to time can inspire flesh and blood to go together with them against you. Because of enemies, we need to be discreet in the information we release. We need to be discreet in how much we can tell, how much we cannot tell. Because if you're just an open tin can, everything goes in, everything comes out, you will never achieve your goals. You will never achieve your goals. The opposition that is stirred up in you will be too great. It's just like, for example, in the little venture that I had in the science area, right? You read the science book, I wrote two books, there's nothing mentioned about God. Although I'm a believer in God and give God the glory for what He gives, but I cannot. Because the moment they see the name of Jesus Christ, they will throw that book into the waste paper basket. See, there's only so much information you can give. And after a certain time, then you can give more information. In order to achieve those goals that you need to have in life. And there's sometimes when I deal with the people of the world, I cannot tell them who I am. I cannot tell them I'm a minister of God, a pastor. Because the moment I tell, they shut their minds out. So I don't tell them that first. I don't tell them that first. I deal in other areas first. Then you tell, by that time your goals has been achieved. See, that's sneaky. That's not being sneaky. That's what Jesus means when He said, be wise as serpent and harmless as dove. So here Nehemiah knows how to get the experience he needs. Quietly go about his experience, silently surveying the task that he has in mind. So number one, experience, get it quietly, get it without people knowing what you're doing. It's just like spying out the land, gathering information. There are a lot of times when I need information, sometimes on the secular realm, secular world. So I would not identify myself as a minister. I identify myself as something else. You can always identify yourself as something else. Oh, I'm a director of a company. Well, that's one identification. Or something else. Oh, I'm organizer of seminars. Then the hotels look at you differently. You say you're a pastor, they look at you, huh? Because when you look, say you're a pastor, they look at you, they're not even willing to sit down and negotiate room rates with you. They're not even willing to negotiate convention rates with you. They look at you think that you don't have money. And when you say they are organizer of seminars, their eyes go green. They see dollar signs. Because when they look at you, they say, wow, you know, how nice to have this guy having more seminars at my hotel. It will help me to make more profits. Then they're willing to sit down and discuss. See that sometimes you cannot tell people information because it will defeat you in so doing. But after you discuss all those things and talk about conventions they're going to organize, how many people are going to come, participants, you don't call them Christians, you call them participants. Then they begin to calculate the cost and look at the whole thing. And let me tell you frankly, it's that way. Because I organize it from the looking at it from secular lens, and they treat you differently. A whole world of a difference. They roll the red carpet for you. They give you, you know, forms. They give you special gifts that they don't give if you go as a pastor. They don't at all. Why? They will give you those things because in view of what is to come. They'll be willing to give you things that normally they won't give. So in the same way, that's why we need the experience that we need to keep our mouth shut at times. Not to tell too much, but to tell only what is necessary. The other aspect is very important. When you got past that stage of experience, gaining your own information, you experience and keeping quiet until you're all ready. It is just like playing a chess game. If you ever play chess, one of the most important things is, number one, develop your pieces. Number two, control the center. Number three, anticipate your opponent's moves. A lot of people who don't play chess, first three moves want to go for checkmate. You can do that to a beginner. You do that to an expert player, you lose your queen. Right? Too fast. You see, when you play chess, you're not supposed to launch an attack until all your pieces are developed. All your pieces means your two rooks, two knights, two bishops, your queen, your king is safely castled away. But the average player, three pieces come up, bishop come up, queen come up, knight come up, chee. 10 moves later, checkmate. See, it's not a game of chess where you're just placing your pieces in position. Looks like nothing is happening, but there's a lot happening. You're targeting your plan, how to attack. But you got to get it all ready, everything in position. Once in position, you launch, and there's non-stop attack. If you are not ready and you launch a premature attack, this is what happens. As you attack and exchange some pieces, you're left with one or two pieces left, and the other four pieces are not developed. You have to hold your attack in order to bring the others up. That's not a good style of playing, if you ever play that way. The best style, develop it properly. Once you attack, it's non-stop attack, and the person will be defending all the way until checkmate. So it's important that we need to know that the background work determines your success. If you don't have enough background work and you launch your attack on your goals, you will not get your success. Because halfway along you say, hey, I forgot to do this, I forgot to do that. By that time, any delay is critical. You don't fly up on a plane, and then while the plane is taking off, you say, I forgot to tighten the screws. Too dangerous by that time. You can't even get off the plane and tighten the screws. You have to have an emergency landing, praying God that the screws don't come off. No, there's some things when it's too late. When you're setting and you're launching into your goal, remember, achieving your goals is that way. You're like a lion, all ready for the prey. You've got to position yourself. Once you launch, you cannot stop. It's just a lion going after a zebra, going after an animal, a deer, or something. Once a lion launches an attack, it has to be constant to get one. If you don't get it, it's wasted effort, wasted energy. So you have to be very sure that you can checkmate before you launch an attack. If you're not sure, you don't launch it yet. You develop, you prepare, you pray for an opening. I find that the better a person is a chess player, the harder it is to launch an attack. And so what you do is you just play positional game until that guy makes a mistake. Because somebody's bound to make a mistake somewhere along the line. So it's important for us to prepare, experience, gather all this information, etc. And all your ammunition. You don't start a war, just like the United States in the Gulf War. They don't just launch an attack. No, if they launch an attack, they find, hey, we don't have enough planes now, what to do? No, they position all their ammunition, all their planes, all their missiles, all their anti-missiles. All that, they place it on the Gulf. And then they launch an attack. That's the way to go about getting our objectives done. Position your pieces. Position your moves carefully. And once you move it, it's non-stop. All the way. And it has been said, after the analysis of the Gulf War, everything was over, one military analyst said, if Saddam Hussein had attacked immediately, Saudi Arabia and all the rest, it would have been a different story. But his delay was to the advantage of the Americans. Because that delay allowed them to develop and build such a force there. That it, later if he attacked, it would have been impossible. So it's important for us to do that. There are too many people launching into their goals without enough preparation. They do it halfway. Some don't realize how it will be when you begin launching into house payments or buying a car. Starting is nice, the first 3 months, you enjoy it. After that, you realize, hey, you have a loan of about 3 years and then you're paying off, it doesn't look quite enjoyable now. No! You should have prepared everything and know what you are going to face. Then when you launch into it, you go all the way. But in speaking about that, let me also mention a fourth thing that I forgot to mention in regard to last week. If you have set goals on purchasing better cars or homes, remember this, whenever you can, without emptying your savings, pay off early. You save more paying early than paying exactly on time. Even if you sign for a car loan for 5 years, if you have the capacity to pay it off in 2 years, please do. You will gain more. But there are people who don't. Even if they have, they don't. They don't calculate. You actually gain more. There are people who sign up for houses 25 years, 30 years, perhaps through business deals or through some venture. They have a surplus above and beyond. You know what you should do? Pay it off quickly. Pay off your house as quickly as you can. If you got the advantage to pay it off early and get everything over transacted quickly, get it done. It's to your advantage. That's the other thing that we need to take note of. Don't just drag. A lot of people just drag it, no? Well, they spend in a bank and they still just keep on, you know, paying off all those things. No, it's not good. It's never good to be in debt. And the only reason that people go into debt for houses and cars is because society and the price of things is such that most people are unlikely able to buy it with cash. So, whenever you can, get out of debt. The sooner, the better. Get out of debt immediately without emptying your savings, but build up your supplies. So, here we move from the silent and experience into what I call the charisma. Why do we need charisma? Let me explain.
We are not just talking about a businessman who have about 10 to 50 to 100 or 1,000 employees under him. Of course, in those situations, everyone knows you need some sort of leadership quality and charisma. But even if you're a Lone Ranger artist with Tonto carrying your pistols, and all you have is want to launch in a career of professional artist, you still need charisma. You need charisma to deal with those who sell paintings. You need charisma to deal with people who will be interested in promoting your artistic qualities and abilities. If you cannot convince them, you've got to do everything yourself. It's a long, long, hard, difficult way. You can achieve it, but it may take about 4 times the length to achieve that goal. Everyone in life knows that somewhere along the line, you have to have people believe in your goals. The same like our church project, it will cost millions of dollars. We cannot do it alone. But we need to have enough charisma so that when we talk to the bank believes in us. So that when we talk to a businessman who could invest in the area, they could believe in us because we carry that charisma to them. But you talk to someone without charisma, they cannot convince you. They look at you, they know it's a flop from the beginning. But there's something about charisma. Now, don't take it wrongly. These are what I define to be the qualities of charisma. Number one, confidence. And the person has confidence and the person inspires confidence in others. An ability to inspire confidence in others. And a person who is confident. Now, you cannot be confident if you didn't go to the first stage and you didn't do your homework. Which is why I never like to go to the public without enough information. Because I don't have enough information to hold the leadership necessary. But you give me enough information on any project, and I believe there is a valid project, I could pursue it. But if I don't have enough information, and I don't have enough things or strategy, and I don't have the goals, and I cannot tell people, when people ask, when will it be completed? They say, don't know, someday. How much will it cost? I don't know, quite a lot. How many houses? I don't know, quite a lot. We cannot do anything. Nobody will believe in you, because you don't have goals. We have said last week, even if you don't have the money, if you had a goal set, and you ask somebody to help who has the money, because you have your goals set, people are more willing to help you too. That's involved in this. What I call charisma. A charisma is the ability that you have to inspire others to work with you, to inspire others to achieve the objective with you. And it's something that you're not necessarily born with. It's something that you develop. Let me tell you, our Lord Jesus has charisma. He walks into the room and you will know He walks in. When our Lord Jesus goes into town, you will know that He was there. The devils knew that He was there. The way He talked, the way He moved, the way He spoke, people said, there is something there about the man of Nazareth. Lord Jesus says it. Now, the opposite of that, do you know these con people, con men? Try to imitate that. A con person who tries to convince others that they have a valid business going on when it's just a scheme would try to imitate charisma. They dress in a 3-piece suit, drive an expensive car that doesn't belong to them. To convince people. Now that's a negative side. But have you seen that the negative side is an imitation of the positive? Without that, you cannot get your goals done too. Don't look at the negative, at all these con people and say, you know, all these con men and con people. And you say, no, I'm going to avoid all those things. And then you find it's a hard struggle to achieve your goals. You need those things. Not that you're going to do all those things that they did. You don't copy their method, but their principles that they have copied and they have brought the wrong methods in. And the principles behind it is you've got to convince others that your goals are reachable. It's not just to tell others. Remember, Goal setting and goal achievement is not just telling people your goals. Any Tom, Dick, and Harry can tell their goals, but you have to convince people that your goals are reachable, and you also have to convince people that they can, if they come together with your goals, they will also come out a winner with you. So it goes a long way. You set up a new company, and you're saying, well, you know, I don't need any charisma. You find that you need. Perhaps you're selling a product that could be sold at the supermarket. You have to convince the supermarket that your product is a necessity there. You find that there's a lot, even though they're not within your umbrella or your company, outside when you begin to deal with them, you need charisma. You need charisma in order to convince people, in order to forward your objectives. So charisma involves, number one, confidence. If Nehemiah had called the people and said, well folks, I'm not sure we're able to do this or not. I'm not sure we can, you know, really get these walls done. But let's just try. No, if we cannot, never mind. And so I'm not sure the price that we have to pay. And I'm very frightened myself as much as you. And I know the situation. And speak all these things. Half of the people won't follow him. But he stood up with the people and he said, let's do it. Let's do it. And he tells them the price he has paid to be there. Tells them that they are able to be. He inspires confidence in them. Even when at times they look at the refuse heap and they say, this is too much. Look at the next few chapters in chapter 4. Then Judah said, the strength of the laborers is failing. And there is so much rubbish that we are not able to build a wall. A charisma is someone who encourages others, who puts confidence in others. You're around people, quote unquote, that you think have charisma, you know what happens? You like it. Why do you like it? Because they inspire you to confidence. They inspire you. They encourage you. That's what we define charisma. So it's not something that you have to be born with. It's something that you know what is it about and then you can have it. Why do a lot of people don't have charisma? Because they're negative. Their name's Negatron. So they don't inspire confidence. Negative people don't inspire. They discourage. And in this life, it is more natural to be negative than to be positive. To be positive, we have to learn. We have to encourage ourselves first before we can encourage others. Now you know why so few have charisma? Because they just allow the waves of the negative world to just go along with them. The average person who brings up children brings them out in fear. Average person who teach others teaches in fear. Don't do this, don't do that, don't. And we are all gripped with fear. See, charisma inspires others. You have confidence. Then the Bible says that confidence comes from faith in God. Hebrews 11 verse 1. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. The assurance or confidence of things not seen. The second thing about charisma is friendliness. Friendliness. People whom you say have charisma are friendly. They have the ability to break the ice. People are born naturally with igloos over their heads. It takes an ice pick to dig out those igloos in people's lives. You could be sitting in a conversation with people and everybody just stares. Nobody has charisma, but the one who has charisma comes, breaks the ice, inspires others. Why? Because the person is friendly. They would be the very first person that will reach out and grab your hand. Now that's an imitation of that. There are some people who are insecure and outwardly they have to be the main jester in town or the jovial person, jolly good fellow of any party. And I met some of those. Inside they are insecure. And that's the way of getting attention. We're not talking about that. That's an imitation. Well, when you sit at that table, that person is always the one who controls the conversation of everybody. Tells all the joke, makes everybody laugh. Top entertainer of the table. We're not talking about that. That's not charisma. There's a sick person who needs attention. We're not talking about that. Every great leader in history has needed the ability to inspire a following. And they have to develop that. One of those factors, I would say number two, is friendliness. The ability to make somebody feel at home with them. Not someone who is aloof, a recluse. And friendliness, my friends, is something we all can learn. We all can learn. Friendliness is something we can develop. Friendliness must come from a genuine concern for people. It is not just self-serving, it's a genuine concern. Then people will know that there's a true, deep friendliness that's coming from the person. See, all these people who came with Nehemiah knew that Nehemiah was a special person. He was friendly to them. He did things that other governors didn't do. So he inspired confidence and a following. In the Bible, in the book of Nehemiah chapter 3, Nehemiah chapter 5, notice what he says here. Verse 14, moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor, in the land of Judah, from the 20th year until the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the governor's provision. Look how he cared for the people. Verse 15, but the former governors who had been before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Yes, even their servants have ruled over the people, but I did not do so because of the fear of God. Verse 17, moreover, there were at my table 150 Jews and rulers besides those who came to us from the nations around us. He always had them. He entertained them. They sat and ate with him constantly. That is a friendly guy. How do we know? Because the average person, modern person today in that position is a recluse. You don't see them except once in a blue moon. You cannot move into your homes and say hello easily. Why they are dignified, high position, cannot reach them. You have to reach them with a long pole, loan from them. But not Nehemiah. He had a friendliness, a genuine concern that flows from his life. Now let's get back to the application area. You could be a fantastic artist. And you, fantastic artist, but you have one of the most nasty tempers, one of the toughest person to deal with, the most unfriendly person ever, but fantastic at your art. Let me tell you, all the art houses dislike you. They don't like to promote your art. They don't like to sell your art. They don't like you. They wait till you die. You could have the best restaurant in town, and everybody in town talks about your special fried kway teow. Everybody knows your food is good. People line up. After some time, it gets into your head. Your head piles up. You don't buy, come. Don't buy, go. Proud. Unfriendly. Wait till another store comes. Because sooner or later, somebody's going to come with that same quality and take. Immediately, all those fellows who just tolerate the scolding, tolerate the abuse, tolerate all those nasty things you say to them while they're buying your fried kway teow, the moment there's an available store close to your shoe, they're all gone. But in the world it's that way. During the time of an overload of hotels in the past years, Singapore, and maybe the same here, some of the hotels will do anything to get you. Roll the red carpet for you. But when it reached capacity and every hotel in town is full, now you got to beg for room. Or seminar convention place. They don't return your calls. They don't answer you. Wait. Wait until somebody provides a facility, we run off. See, people are unhappy. It's dangerous. And one of my contacts who rang up during those early days when we were looking for a place, he rang up and the hotel answered, not so friendly, very rude. And he is one of the top management person in a big firm too. And he says, wow, now you all talk differently. And he says, must be very good times. And the person was convicted, not by the Holy Ghost. And I said, be born again. But he said, yeah. He realized, something wrong in that kind of attitude. Wait. It doesn't last long. You never get away with abusing people for long. For long. Someday it will hit back. And usually pride comes just before a fall. That means when there is pride, you can expect sooner or later there's a fall coming about. Friendliness goes a long way. It is better to be that same artist, even if you cannot reach that level of the other person. Maybe the other guy was a fantastic genius of an artist. You're 3/4 of his genius. We cannot call you Tiga Suku. But you could make it, but you know you cannot reach that person's level. Maybe in 5 years time you could reach that person's level because the person is way ahead. But you have a difference. You have a marketing strategy and you know how to make friends. You go to those art houses and dealers that are very important in promotional art. Stay with them, genuine concern for them. I want to profit too, of course, but I want you to profit too. They sense it, they promote you. Let me tell you, in the ministry, the same thing. We deal with bookstores, Christian bookstores, and you'd be surprised how unchristian Christian bookstores can be too. When I first started selling books, I didn't realize how much of a marketing strategy you need. So I just said, well, we'll give you 20%. Nobody wants to sell my books, except myself. Then when we got news back, we realized, hey, they want 40 to 50%. I said, what? Excuse me. Then I realized, hey, a lot of them are out there making money. I'm thinking about ministry, they're thinking about money. So how do I deal with them? I could say, forget it, you worry guys. Repent. No. I'll say, Father, forgive them for they know not what they do. But we can do what they can't do. So he said, alright. So the next time, we price a book. We said, now when we price a book, we must think in terms of minus 50%. So we have a pricing strategy too. Say, alright, no problem then. When you start buying, we start at 40. If buy more, up to 1,000 pieces, then it's 55%. We give up to 55%. Right? In case anybody here invested. Anyway, no. We're not selling our books here. I have a policy where I seldom sell my own books or promote my own books, right? This is just part of sermon. But I'm just sharing how I have to learn. I have to learn that there's a lot more to go to ministry than just that. Even if you have the most important anointed book, people may see not want it. And I deal with a lot of bookstores who think in terms of profit still. I say, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. But oh God, let's continue. Let's, Father, how do we go about that? And so we do a relationship with them. So we do our best to promote them too. I think in terms of them. So when I travel to a place, I could sell my own books and get back about, even if I give a 10% discount, I get back 90% of the retail price. But then because I care for them and they know my concern, since you are selling my books, if I go to those areas, although you buy my books at 55% off, I let you sell them. Although I get back only 45% of what they sell. And the other 55%, they got it. I could sell it and get the extra 90 minus 45%. Which is 45%. Which is the other 45%. But, you know, I don't think in terms of dollars or cents. Because I think in terms of when I'm not there, when I'm not in those places, those are the places that people can go to get the books and the ministry can continue. If I think of dollars and cents and not think about them, helping them, then cannot. It won't work. So because of all these errors, which is why I'm sharing how even in the ministry we have to learn. How much more in the business, where everything is business and there are a lot of unbelievers, snakes and vultures going to eat you up. How much more that we have to learn that it pays to be friendly. It goes a long way. It goes a long, long way. And sometimes those people just don't learn. I have my favorite barber shop just outside my house. Right? I find it difficult to go to all those saloons. I don't know what they'll do with my hair. And I tell you, nobody cuts hair as well as those special Indian barbers. They are experts. $6 per cut. Can recommend to you. But sometimes I think they lack marketing strategy. They see my face once a month, and every time I go there, I have to tell them what I want. And so one fine day, there are only three of them. They each take turn. Sat in one of the chairs, and I said, trim. You know why I said trim? Because if I say cut, it means botak. They use a different phrase. Cut means botak, trim means cut. And so I said, trim. And that guy gave me such a shortcut that I said, hey, this is a schoolboy's cut. I have to be careful in my hair because if it's too short, I don't look like minister, I look like schoolboy. And so, I told the guy, hey, I've been here so long and you know me. And I went back, I told my wife, I'm not going back again. But at the end of the month, I was thinking, evaluating my options to explore a new saloon and barber or to go back to the old one. I discussed with my wife. So I made a decision. I said, I'll give them one more chance. Right. And when I went back, I saw the same guy again. I said, no, not you, sir. There were three barbers. So I said, no, I prefer the other guy. And so I'm still going back there, the other guy. But as I look back, I realized, hey, if only this barber shop realized, if you get one client, it's permanent. It's just like selling insurance. When you sell a policy, for the next couple of years, you get paid on a percentage of the premium. For a number of years. It could be 5 years, 6 years, whatever. Same with a provision shop. When you open a provision shop, once you sell to one customer, that's a potential customer because they will need rice in the next month. They need provisions in the next month. It's a continuous thing. Every addition is a continuous thing. So the same way when we do in business, we need a friendliness. If you're thinking of long range, So charisma involves a friendliness that I believe Nehemiah had. There was a friendliness that he had that attracted the people to him. You could have the best programs, the best business, but you're the most unfriendly person on earth. People would say, forget it. They want nothing to do with it. But the friendship part goes a long, long way. I could assure you that if you had to buy something, let's say a piece of furniture or a supply of soap or whatever, and you had 2 persons who sold the product, and you wanted to buy it, most probably you will always call the person who was more friendly. Not the person who was less friendly. The friendliness gets the extra mile. And they're able to win people to follow it. The same way with a bank. The same way with your relationship with a bank. You could be unfriendly, you could be friendly. A relationship that we all learn to develop. The third area is vitally important. In the third area, remember that in goals, you will always have enemies and opposition. And they will move from one degree to the next. The first degree that they have, immediately when he verbalized his plan, in chapter 2, verse 19, Sanballat the Horonite, who was quite a horror, Tobiah the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arab heard of it. They laugh us to scorn and despise us. Remember, when you have goals, that is number 3. Number 1, the silent period, gain experience. Number 2, now the silent period, gain experience, it could mean that if you have a goal to set up your own business, now you're working for somebody, what you need to do is gain what experience you can. You have your goal, and you know that sometimes experience, there's no shortcut. You just have to take the time to gain the experience. Then, number 2, friendliness, the charisma that involves confidence, number 1. Number 2, friendliness. Then number 3, working out your goals, prepare for opposition. There are a lot of people who set goals who didn't prepare for opposition. I was not prepared for opposition in the beginning of my ministry when I went to the ministry. I didn't realize that in the ministry people also can oppose. I was very surprised. But now you live with it, and now you enjoy it like Paul. Now you take it with a smile. But when I remember the first difficulty I had in the seminary, there I was hungry for God, hungry for the Bible, got baptized in the Spirit, got involved in the charismatic movement, and then there was passing remarks on you. I remember the first opposition I had, I was crying over the seminary intercom to one senior student, and I said, oh, I want to go home. Crying, big fat tears flowing down, not crocodile, real one. Pain in your heart. Then as you grow in God, those tears become less. Now you still cry, but for different reasons. You cry out of compassion, not out of crisis. And then it reached a stage where you begin to look forward to them, because now you realize that, Paul, when you're weak, then you are strong. You begin to realize that they're a part of your training. And then I began to realize, if there was no opposition, the qualities of your character that need to be there will not be formed. Paul makes it in a long way, the same statement in Romans 5. Tribulation worketh, after all the things it works, character. Tribulation is equal to persecution, difficulty, opposition. Tribulation produces patience, and in the end it produces character. You see, just go with me on an imaginary trip. I always used to think and fantasize and imagine, for example, what happens if on other planets there are beings? What size will they be? Let's say, supposing that on Jupiter, and which is the largest planet, and on Titan, Saturn, there are their being. Or let's say on the moon, if they are being. The bigger the planet, the greater the gravitational force. The gravitational force of Jupiter is much, much more than the Earth. I have always imagined as a small boy, if there were creatures up there, and if man one day were to live on Mars and colonize it, or on a big planet with heavy gravity, I've always wondered, to what size will man grow to? Will they be short, tall, big or small? But by today's knowledge, we know it already. Because when an astronaut goes in the outer space where there is no way, when they come back after over a year in space, their muscles all grow smaller. Their bones shrink. So we know. In my mind last time, I used to think that if there were creatures in Jupiter, they would be very small because of the heavy gravity, so cannot grow big. But now I realize it's opposite. The lighter the gravity, the smaller the person. Because the resistance that you take to develop against gravity is less. So you don't need as many muscles, you don't need as much resistance, and you grow small. And I believe that if ever they colonize space and have a space station, and a baby was to be born in space and grew up in space, it will be a dwarf. Small little fellow. And may never be able to live on Earth, because when they move on Earth, cannot move. Not used to gravitational force. He'll be small. But the heavier the gravity, the bigger the development, because more muscular structure. Now think about that in resistance. The more there is resistance to your goals, the more it requires something in you to overcome it. The harder it is, it takes more ideas, it takes more talent. It takes more stamina. So supposing you're training for the Olympic race. Don't train on an easy path, right? You never train the easiest. You train the hardest. It's just like weightlifting, right? Just, I carry dumbbells and I pray in tongues. So, you notice when you carry dumbbells and you pray, just to prove the point, you know, somebody challenged me. Said, brother, you say that it's so easy in the natural, all you have to do is obey natural laws and it will always work because you compare the spiritual laws. He said, in the spiritual, you need to exercise frequently to get it. And a person challenged me and said, you know, are you sure you can do it in the natural? You're skinny, you know. So this is no problem, except that I don't have the time to do it. I used to mention in an illustration, if I had the time, you know, you could look like Arnold Schwarzenegger, no problem. But I don't have the time. I don't have 3 hours to go. Just a matter of time. But then I thought about what that person said. I said, alright, since I walk about and pray in tongues, I don't have time to exercise, but let me just carry something while I pray in tongues and see the difference. And there was a difference. But I noticed this. If you carry 20 kilos and then after that you carry 6 kilos, it's like nothing. But if you carry 6 kilos, then you carry 6 kilos, you still feel it. Don't believe me, you go and try. Borrow somebody, go to somebody's gym. Carry 20 kilos. Hold it for 5 minutes, let it go. Then go and carry 6 kilos. You find it's different. So when you try, when you train, you always take the most difficult. If you're training for the marathon race, that could be, for example, 5 miles. Let me tell you, run 10 miles. Slowly, of course, not immediately. 10 miles. Until you're comfortable with 10 miles, while others are training 5 miles. By the time it comes to you, your 5 miles is just half. You run like Billy the Whiz. If you're coming against a circumstance that is difficult, it takes something in you to overcome it. And I notice that we need those difficult times. We need those difficult things. It is through times of difficulty that your toughness and the best in you comes out. It's in a crisis that the worst or the best in you come out. Look at President Bush. If there were no Gulf War, today they would still be criticizing him as a limpy, wishy-washy president. Let me tell you, that was what all the magazines, the Newsweek, Time magazine, all of them were criticizing all the time. He's just a diplomat. He has no leadership quality. Look at the Time magazine. Check it out in the past, in the libraries. You will find that was all the criticism he had. But now after Gulf War, different story. They say he's the right guy. Because the crisis brought the best in him. However, the crisis could have brought the worst in him. If he, in Malaysian style, kalang kabut, make a wrong mistake, finish. Today they'll be calling for a new election. Because a crisis and an opposition brings the best or the worst in you. No halfway. Do you notice there's no halfway in a crisis or persecution? You either have the best in you or the worst in you coming out. We pray God that through the word of God, the best in you will come out. When the best in you come out, that's when you will have the qualities necessary to achieve those goals and to retain those goals. Now the opposition, that's number three, came in three different ways. The first way was people mocking them, laughing at them. Get used to people laughing, jeering and mocking you while you're setting your goals. Get used to people saying it cannot be done, cannot be done. Get used to it. If you're not used to it, you're not prepared. So at the first level, they just laugh, they just mock, they just scorn. And Nehemiah paid no attention to them. But the second level was worse. This Sanballat fellow was not giving up. In chapter 2, in verse, chapter 4, in verse 2, verse 3, 2 and 3. Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him. Sanballat and Tobiah. And he said, whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. And they say all these things. And in verse 7, now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah the Arab, the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gates were beginning to be closed. They became angry. I tell you, if all you face is a mocking opposition, it's only phase one. You haven't faced an angry one yet. When people are angry at you because you got those goals. Why? Because Tobiah and Sanballat did not want the walls to be built. They did not want the Jewish goals to be achieved. Be prepared. There will be people who don't want you to change. There will be people who prefer that you be where you are. Why change? Please, we want you to remain the same. Poor, pitiful, needing charity. There will be people who say, don't change. Why change? Why? Because as long as you don't change, they can lord it over you. And those same people, devil behind them, gets angry when you set your goals. Remember, if you haven't started yet, the devil is not angry yet. All he does is laughing at you. But when you start digging in, that's when he gets angry. So my friends, if all you face is a mocking devil, rejoice. It's only first stage. Second stage is an angry devil facing you. If you have got the devil angry at you, you say, hey brother, don't talk about being angry at the devil. You have to, because the devil cannot and will not compromise on any area. You cannot make a deal with the devil. And say, devil, you don't disturb me, I don't disturb you. Don't be angry, I won't be angry at you. He won't. He hates you. So if you face an angry devil, rejoice. You are now at phase two. Now when they face angry opposition, it took half the energy to handle it. It says here in chapter 4, this is the conclusion. Verse 21, so we labored in the work and half the men held the spears on daybreak until the stars appeared. It took half of their workforce to prepare against any attack. Some of us, if you are facing a situation, you say, I wish I had a momentum earlier. Now with opposition, half of my energy is spent tackling the opposition. Rejoice. It is part of goal setting and working out your goals. Because as you set your goals, there's a price to pay. Now this is where we talk about the price. Where before you launch into your goal, 2 hours prayer was sufficient. Now you're halfway in your goal. If you don't finish it, you're worse than when you began. That's when you start praying 4 hours. Say, God, I really need you. You don't get me through this. We are finished. Excellent. That's what God loves. Now you got to double your effort. To do the same work, you got to either double your effort or you have to use the same effort and do half the work in the middle of the opposition. That's only phase two. You must prepare for that. Because there are some people who launch out into that goal setting and halfway they don't realize that when you're somewhere in the middle of it, that it will take twice the effort than when you started. Now anybody who has gone swimming will realize that sometimes if you go into a place, a deeper place, where there could be undercurrents, which we don't advise necessarily, it may take with the current twice the effort to do the same work. But if you were in shallow waters where whatever current there can be, you cannot reach that level. Because the deeper you are, there is more water around, and the current, if it ever grow, can grow stronger. That is why you sit on a ship and you go out into the ocean, out into the open ocean, you'll be surprised how huge the waves are. Waves that you never even see on the shores. Because there's so much available water to carry and accumulate that current. So when you launch out into your ship, the currents you face when you start and the currents you face in the middle of the ocean is more. The worst current is right there in the middle of the ocean. As you near the shore, the current cannot reach that level because the shoreline breaks the current. But the middle is the worst part. And that's where in the middle of your goal, working out your goals, be prepared that it may take twice the effort to do the same work, or the same work to do half the work. The same effort to do half the work. Take courage. Don't be discouraged. Things doesn't seem to move that fast. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Because you're climbing the mountain. When you climb up a mountain, the most difficult part is the nearer you reach the top. The nearer you reach the top, you have already expended a lot of your energy. And the nearer you reach the top, the more steep it becomes sometimes. But take courage, that's when you're close to it. Your strongest opposition is in the middle. Remember that. The middle part is what I call the peak of the graph. Every business, every ministry, every work, every effort, and every goal, the hardest is the middle. It gets harder and harder right to the middle. It reaches a peak. And then, it gets easier after the peak. It's just like a sickness. If you are believing God against a sickness, you know this sickness have a graph. You fight the sickness, confess the word. Then you reach a point when there is a break-even point. After the break-even point, it's all recovery. Sometimes you got instant recovery, but sometimes it's gradual recovery, but you're still healed. But there's a point when the sickness breaks. You know it's over. You know it's over. It's not complete yet, but you know it's over. The worst battle is over for your life. The rest is just automatic as you keep at the same effort. So remember the halfway point in your goal setting. The halfway point, the most dangerous. Also, Chess James, the most complicated, the middle game, the three part, opening, middle, and ending. Because what you do in the middle game determines the end game. If in the middle game I gain all your pieces, I get the best position, the rest is finished for you. Even though it may take another 15 moves to checkmate you, but it's, as far as I'm concerned, the end. That is why a good player sometimes get bad position, resign. They haven't even played it finished to the end, they resign. Because they know in the next 15-20 moves, they are sure to lose. No point playing anymore. Because the middle point is where it's most dangerous. There is a middle point. Let me warn you, there is a middle point. And if you haven't reached a middle point, please put on the armor of God. Please do your homework. Get prepared. Once you pass the middle point, it's smooth sailing all the way. You have learned something in your life and in achieving your goal. Then, the third level of opposition. When you have completed, you think Satan has left you alone. You have beat him up blue and black. You have stepped over him, crushed him, throw him out. And you thought that he will never disturb you again. I want you to look at the last chapter of Nehemiah. He comes in a different way. And you must keep a watch all the time. This is the part that people forget after they work out their goals. After they pass the middle point in chapter 13. Verse 4. Now, before this, Eliashib, the priest, having authority over the storerooms of the house of our God, was allied with Tobiah. Could you imagine that? He was allied with Tobiah. Now the work is completed. The temple has been built by Ezra. Everything was over. They have passed the halfway mark. They even completed it. Tobiah now lives in the temple. Now you look at chapter 13, the ending. It says there in verse 28, and one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite. Wow! The same people who was against them, mocking, then in the middle of it, they were going to fight them, now join them. But they didn't join with a good purpose. Let me tell you, when you have passed your halfway mark, the battle now is different. The enemy knows he cannot face you face to face. So the enemy now does guerrilla warfare. Sneaks in. Here, through a marriage relationship, he sneaks in. Now, uncle, auntie, then Sanballat and Tobiah came in. Uncle, auntie. That's what the Lord warned me. When you have success in your goals, or you see, the moment you pass the halfway mark, you're already having some success. When success begins to come and you pass the halfway mark, remember who your enemies are and who your friends are. Because anyone who has not been tested and tried cannot be your teammate. They will be dangerous. Face it. When you have reached your goals and you're a multi-millionaire successful business, possibly half of those who are your friends are not your real friends. They are there because you have the cash and you have the success that they could earn from. And there are a lot of people who let their guards down when they succeed. That's what destroys them. Because we all go through different cycles. There will be a next cycle where you got bigger goals and you face tougher opposition. Halfway through, the Sanballats and the Tobiah who live with you now are going to kill you from inside. So we must purify. We must know. And that is why I have this personal policy. Only those who have been through my worst times and my crisis can ever stand shoulder to shoulder with me in any closeness and any work with God. Not that you don't trust people, but you haven't tested them out. There could be people who really love you and who are sincere, but if they have never been tested, they are not ready yet. Now, don't give them up. They may be ready sometime later. But you never put, and that was a failure of many people, even Catherine Kuhlman when she died. When she succeeded and the ministry expanded, when she died, the people who were most friendly to her during her sick days before she died, she go and promote them and give them all the rights to her property. And the people who were with her closest, Maggie, some of her close workers, got nothing at all. It was a sad thing. Whether she was compelled to do it, but it was a sad ending. Because those people only came to her life after she has passed a halfway mark. In fact, she's completed. But those who came into her life at the beginning, that's when she should have honored them. So we need to know. We need to know. In your business, in your work, in your goal setting, that we all need teammates. We need teammates to run with us, to pace with us. Know whom you can trust. Know whom you can depend on. Love everybody. Trust the Lord. You'll find you cannot trust all. Sadly. Because not all come to the same capacity. That's what many people forget in their goal setting, achieving their goal. So let's go to God in prayer. Remember those 3 points.